Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to our edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Fred. How's it going?
Hey, good, good. Got my coffee. I'm ready to go.
All right. Good.
You know, that makes for good conversation and slurping sounds in the background.
I've never experienced you without coffee. I'm a little afraid since you don't let it happen. You know, like it's it's like your daily Jekyll and Hyde, like medicine to make sure you only stay on one side. Is that what happens? What happens when you don't drink your coffee?
Oh, well, very, very quick story. We were flying internationally and we had an early flight. And the hotel had leftover can of diesel oil they called coffee. And so we passed on that, figured, well, we can get it at the airport. We're checking into the airport at the little lounge waiting for the plane. And the receptionist is calling somebody saying, well, do you even have instant?
Uh-oh, the alarm bells are going off in
your
head.
Right. So Diane and I are looking at each other like, oh, this is not good. And so we get on the plane, right? And we're sitting in business. And we can see the flight attendants, and this tall, good-looking gentleman has his Starbucks, you know, grande, standing there chatting. And you can smell the coffee. It's ready to go. And I'm like, we don't take off for an hour. Why don't you pour the coffee? So I walk up and ask him, and I goes, oh, no, go ahead, have a seat. We'll get to you. We'll get to you. And he continues with his conversation. So I look at him, and I say, look, if you don't get it, I know how to open that coffee pot, and I'll go find a cup. You don't want to have us, especially my wife, without coffee. It gets ugly.
Oh, God. So, all right, so I was right. I don't ever want to see this.
No. You can threaten flight attendants with it. It's that bad.
Oh, my God. Okay. All right. Noted.
Yeah.
Noted.
Yeah. So have you been off to some other adventures and stuff? You had an article came out. See, I think when this will get published, it would be a couple of weeks ago, and you're going to have to link to it. But were you off dog sledding? Was that the deal here?
I was. I did dog sledding, which was awesome. I did it with my daughter. We were up at the Arctic Circle area, and that's as specific as I can be, which makes it sound very mysterious. We went dog sledding, and it was amazing. First of all, these dogs, you know, you kind of expect big huskies or whatever. Mm-hmm. And these dogs, they're not huge. They are lean and just muscle rippling through the skin. And it makes sense. They're marathon runners. They look like marathon runners, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they don't even have super thick fur because they're always trying to stay cool, but they love sleeping in the snow. Like they are just optimized perfectly for this sport. Mm-hmm. But you know, obviously a lot of things caught my interest. But one was, so the Bob, he's an Iditarod champion. Iditarod's the, you know, races they do that go on for days and days and days. Dog set races, they go on for 10 days, 15 days. And
Yeah. It's an endurance run, essentially.
Oh, it's crazy. And they sleep at night. Like he said that they have camps set up to sleep in, but the dogs don't like all the noise of everything else in the camp. So he's like, we all just walk out in the woods and they just hunker down and I hunker down and we sleep in the snow. I'm like, Jesus Christ. And I was like, oh my, this guy is intense. And he's in his 70s and he looks amazing. And he's been doing this for like 40 years. Mm-hmm. So, but of course, like anybody who's passionate about a sport that has any equipment in it, you get really into the technology too in advancing it. So you kind of, by definition, become an inventor, you know? So of course I had tons of questions, and he was very excited. Somebody was interested in all his inventions over the years, and he had a great history of a lot of them in his barn, you know. So I was asking about the skis, you know, the runners on the bottom. Mm-hmm. And you know, so he took me through like 40 years of development he's done with it. And one of the things that surprised me was how much he'd experimented with materials. You know, I kind of in my mind pictured he's a purist, right?
Just pure local fur, whatever hardwood they got available. And
well, I was picturing like metal, wood, you know, leather, things like that. He's like,
Teflon.
Oh, yeah, totally. Teflons. He knew all about the different, you know, the chemistry and the different types and when things advanced and occurred. And I was like, oh, my God. And you know, all kinds of other inventions. This braking steering system he made was amazing. These carpet, it's like a small carpet. and it has very specific patterns of hard metal shapes on it that he's made, where he steps on it and it can, you know, adjust the speed based on how the dogs are pulling. The dogs also can tell how much he's doing it, mm-hmm. and he can do it lopsided to create a pull one direction or the other, and the dogs right. pick up on it. So he created this pad that almost works as like a joystick for the dogs that he can step. It's crazy.
I mean, so I get the image of like a dog sled. The person stands behind the sled on a little shelf, and you're saying those pads are like right there on his feet or behind next to his feet.
Exactly. So picture a mud flap for a truck tire, but it's down at ground level, right?
Well, I know
so
you use an automotive example.
Of course. Yeah.
Like he doesn't stand on them full time, right? He has a hard platform, and then he steps on these two little steering wheel things on the sides.
That's right. He steps back, so it's like a brake pedal that's behind you.
Oh, okay.
But he's turned it into a musical instrument. I would say the way he can play it, and the dogs can read it, and it can, like, it's just, yeah, it's crazy.
Well, there's so many different kinds of snow conditions, from slush to, you know, light fluffy stuff and everything else, and he's probably experimented on all those areas. I'm just thinking the Iditarod, it's such a long race, and over, like you said, 10 days over such a distance, that I'm sure they run into all those conditions in one event. You know, how does he deal with that? How do you optimize that way?
Oh, he has tons of inventions for swapping things out quick. The way he can switch out his runners the same way like a Formula One car team can switch tires at a pit stop.
He's like six dogs on the side come out and rip off the old runners and
exactly. But like, it's not this whole complex system with screws and whatever. Like, it slides in, clips in here. You put one screw here and it holds it. You know, like it right, just right. like. It's not, he's not messing around, and he's not wasting time. He's racing, you know?
Wow.
And and also with those pads too. Like, he made it so that you can get him on and off quick because he has different patterns for fluffy snow, longer teeth, mm-hmm. icy snow, sharper, shorter one, you know, like, yeah, exactly what you'd picture.
Wow.
But I was like, this guy can just invent and invent and invent. And I'm thinking like, what's his secret to just this? And I realized I was staring right at his secret. I was staring at their butts a lot, but it was that dog team. He had this insanely enthusiastic, always ready test team, test engineers, right? You know, and he just could generate an insane amount of data every day, whenever he wants. So he could do these iterations and get a ton of data quick, right? He could play around with a pad, go out mm-hmm. running for 2 hours, see how the dogs work. You know, he never had to beg for test time or a test stand or whatever.
So you're saying we just need to give dog food to all of our lab folks?
That's it. I think we're done with the podcast. You nailed it.
Jumped ahead. Sorry about that.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was, you know, and you've run into people that are like this, you're like this by far. And you just want to see how it performs. You want to see how it breaks. You want to provide information back, as opposed to, and then you've run into these labs too, is where they will fill out the form and we'll give you final denial in 3 months or something like that. And it's all bureaucratic and get in line and you can't do that here. And, you know, don't touch it. We don't want to break it, which you and I would probably bristle at. But the idea is that you're saying these dogs were, you know, willing and happy, that's what they wanted to do, but they're providing this inventor, Bob, a bunch of information. They're allowing him to run. But he also has like a free test lab, right? As long as there's snow around, he can run, he can test. Whereas our chambers are often either not designed well, or they're, you know, the labs are constrained and budget constrained and all that stuff. He didn't have that problem, right?
Right. That's it exactly, is that he is. Yeah, exactly. So and just to see how enabling that was and how that is really the number one frustration I have when I design, you know, do the architecture for a reliability program plan for an entire product development, you know, program over a year or two.
Or those running shoes you talked about a couple of times.
Or my running shoes. Well, I have a free test. I have a less enthusiastic test engineer there, me, right?
Yeah,
if
yeah.
I go out and run. It's always fighting for test time. I mean, that is the whole thing. I feel like that is just the battle for every product development program I make. The architecture, I'm like, all right, you know, we do a risk analysis. We find all the areas that scare everybody or concerning, we worry about. I'm like, all right, these are the tests we'll do to address them. And then there's this whole like, we don't have time.
We can't do it.
All the
cost too much.
Exactly. And you're just like, the pain of it, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that Bill and Dave at Hewlett Packard did early on in their building of that business is in their very first products, it wasn't a fancy name like agile development, or it wasn't, you know, these fancy terms we got today. It was build, test, fix, build, test, fix, build, test, fix. Just build it, check it, build, you know, break it, fix it. And that was their mantra for decades. And it gets ingrained in the group. And it still ended up in the larger organizations, but it was built into the budget. We had, like for an inkjet printer, we had thousands of prototypes that we could go test this way, that way, and everywhere, each way we can think of, with the intent of, and I think that's one of your catchphrases, Adam, is the intent is to learn something, right? That's why we do it. And if we don't build prototypes to give to the marketing guys and go sell them, no. We give prototypes to engineers that go break them.
Right, right. So the big question hanging out there is, what free, enthusiastic test, you know, technicians do we have that we don't utilize in our programs? And that is a place I turn my customers to a little bit, because you do, both internally and externally.
Oh, yeah. 10-year-olds for game controllers, they're all over it.
Exactly. But, I mean, it might have to be your customers, because maybe it's a complex laser system you can't give to a kid or have somebody take home.
Right.
But what about engaging your customers? Because in a lot of ways, they probably can benefit, right? They probably can benefit from having an opportunity to utilize something that's in prototype mode, or just things they can discover, even for their own, if it's a complex piece of equipment that they have to adapt to in their process.
Mm-hmm. They can get a head start on it.
Yeah. They get a head start on it, you know? And it to me seems like relatively well worth and simple legwork to you know, claim this benefit. And I see so many programs not pursuing it.
Yeah, some do. You know, it's a trade-off. You always get in this tussle with the marketing folks. Well, it'll dampen our launch. We won't be able to build the excitement or anticipation. We do this. We don't want to show our dirty laundry in front of our customers. And, you know, what if the customers is so doesn't like it so much that they tell everybody that it's horrible? You know, there's the fear that of the failure. And I've run into that so many times that it quashes this ability to go do beta testing, go get it in alpha testing, get it in front of some customers. I think it's misplaced. I'm sure you've seen that where somebody says, no, you can't talk to the customers. You're an engineer.
Right. Well, I have a very clean counter argument for that. And my counter argument is that is a very viable concern.
Mm-hmm.
But the what if it mitigates having those events occur on a full-blown scale? What is that like? So how do you know, do you believe that engaging with people, a very small group that knows their expectations are they are getting a prototype and there will be issues and that's the purpose of it,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
That whatever, I find it hard to believe if you really engage them honestly that way that, and you even in some sense reimburse them with a free this or a free that,
mm-hmm,
that their expectation is they're on the team, right? It's kind of exciting. We're on the test team and we're going to find problems. And I mean, so if the alternative is that you're, you know, you could probably point to history in most companies. Remember that time when we released this product full blown, full scale
and we brought them all back. Yeah.
Yeah. How embarrassing was that? How much did that cost us? And do you think it's worth mitigating that with this? And, you know, they have to be pretty hard pressed to come up with a good argument against that. And if they do come up with one against that, I just terminate the conversation because we're just not dealing with somebody who's a real team player and wants the company to succeed. You're dealing with somebody with some short term goal that they want to achieve, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, at that point, because you can't argue that.
No, you got it. It goes to a different realm. It's where you got to show what's the value of it and all those other pieces of it. But I don't know. I've run into it way too many times, and it's just there's so much value. And when you get an enthusiastic customer, and the one I'm thinking of is I was working on game controllers, and 10 to 15-year-olds love breaking game controllers.
Yeah, you know? Right. And the lineup for that.
They try it and and but they also, I mean, they also brought in pro gamers that their sense of feel and of the pressure of the trigger button and the preloading of these sensors and all these other things they could sense and they could articulate was invaluable, absolutely astonishing, the feedback they gave. And so that, you know, once you start getting even a piece of that information and then say, this is how useful this is the difference it made, this is why we do this, then it becomes standard practice. But it's that first time you got to get it out. So we just need a pack of dogs.
Right. You know? Right. Exactly. And the other funny thing is, too, sometimes it can be internal. I mean, so I had a customer once and we had a product and it was a medical product, but it was a very simple kind of thing that you could interact with very simply day to day. And it was meant to be worn by a patient day to day. Right. And we were curious about some of the stresses on the system from being used day to day. And they're talking about, OK, well, you know, we're in, you know, like I was like, all right, this is the type of test fixture we could design. You're like, how much it will cost? I'm like, it'd be about $100,000 to make just one of these. And then we said, well, we could try to, you know, get people outside and stuff. And I'm like, guys, everybody's walking around here all day. Why don't you just put it on people in the office? Like, what's the, you know, and they were like, oh, yeah. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, like, yeah,
take it home, I just, whatever,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, just, you know, just you can get a gazillion miles on this thing, so to speak, by just having 10 people have it on during their day, you know. And I think we overlooked that a lot as well, those opportunities like that.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if the self-driving car folks test it out in their parking lot first. Sort of like when I was learning to drive, we drove around in parking lots.
Right.
You know, it's almost as dangerous, or maybe more so when I was driving.
Oh, I'm sure it was closed. It was closed areas. Well, I mean, I remember when I was working with Boston Dynamics on the big mule, the big robotic horse, you know, testing that in their parking lot. Yeah. And and there was lots of interesting incidents. Actually, you can see different incidents they have on, you know, online. And one of the funniest ones was it had a follow mode where there was a reflector, just kind of a very traditional type of reflector that would be on the soldier's backpack. Mm-hmm. And you just told it, follow, you know, be 10 feet behind me and just follow me.
Right.
There was a BMW that had a bad day that was parked there because it picked up it got confused between the backpack and the taillight. reflector on the car.
Yeah.
And so it was on the backpack. And then as it saw the car, it was like, oh, it's over there all of a sudden. And it didn't know how to handle that. So it just turned right away and just turned right into the car.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah. That horse, that was a couple thousand pound robot. I mean, it's like, you know, it made an impact. I was like, okay. We shouldn't do it.
Well, that's a good thing. You don't expect BMWs on the, but you never know.
Well, the biggest lesson there was we shouldn't do it in a full parking lot. Let's go, because we just walk outside the building. I mean, those are like all the employees' cars.
Well, yeah, they won't see it much unless it's the CEO's car. Then you go, hey, but if you didn't do that, right? If you didn't go out there and try it, they would have never known that. Oh, we got to make this a bit more unique so it keeps attention and then it doesn't get distracted by similar things. Right. And, you know, and they wouldn't have known that in the lab. They would have set up a test pattern in here, you know, all that good stuff. Yeah, it's, you know, and you see some companies, especially things that are more complex and more complicated and expensive, is they have to have that feedback. They'll do pilot runs. And even in a company I was in, when I was in a manufacturing realm, we would set up pilot lines and have tested, you know, big chunks of equipment. And we'd run it for 3-4 months and see how it works and test equipment, measurement systems and everything else to vet it out, to do it. It wasn't part of the development program of what we were trying. We were just looking to see if it worked for us. And you can leverage that mindset. I think that's what you're after here, is that people need to know if it's going to work for them. Is it going to be worth the effort to use this system or product? Give it to them. But it's now some medical devices like an insulin pump, for example, you don't want to just strap that on everybody in the building and tell them to walk around with it.
No. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's protocols for some products.
Exactly. There's limitations. But I guess the message is, be creative and with a little bit of investment, you know, you might find tap into a pretty cool resource of energy and you know, that can be used to get test data. And then once you do that, you can have the fast iterations, right? Because it's not hard to make those iterations or to change a software code to know not to get confused between other types of reflectors or whatever. You know, it's just getting that test data. And, you know, he would have never had those fast development cycles, invention cycles, if he didn't have this test team that was going to go out and test whether he wanted to or not every day. You know, whether or not he invented something, the test stand was going to run, literally.
That's right.
So, yeah, I think that that's in front of a lot of us, and we really don't take the time to utilize it.
Yeah, you know, well, yeah, and you hear about it. You hear people saying, oh, I need to create a test plan. I need to put this together. And it says, well, when are you planning on doing this? And it goes, oh, at the end of the program, just before we launch. And I'm like, okay. We're not doing this isn't going to be valuable feedback to your engineering team. Let's get this stuff in earlier. And that's probably a whole nother discussion. But the idea is to get feedback quickly. It's your use case 7, right? Go figure out how much and how far off can you break it. It's one piece of this, but in general, does it work? Can I turn it on? Can you bump it into a wall and it still work? All that good stuff. That's that feedback that is critical to any program.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it takes so many different levels.
The thing that the dogs don't care if his runners aren't good. You know, they flip the sled over. That's what happens.
Hey, come on. What's wrong with you? Get back there.
Exactly. Or that braking doesn't work. Job. And they all make a right turn, right?
That's so right. Like, right into a robot.
Oh, that was the other thing that was amazing is he could make these very subtle vocal commands and they would turn left or right. Like it was, even when he didn't have his thing on the foot thing, like the way that they all together were a fine-tuned machine was just unbelievable. It was really cool.
Well, that's cool. And you got back safely? No frostbite or any of that good stuff?
No, definitely got very cold at certain times, but good overall. The only real damage is I used K7 a snowmobile and I smashed it a little bit.
Yeah, we talked about that.
One of the episodes. I know about that. Yeah, classic Adam everywhere I go. Right. But it was awesome, and I'm glad that I got to be a part of the trip. And it was really exciting to see an inventor way out there, isolated in the woods, you know, in a very different kind of invention environment, very test based.
Oh yeah. So you came back and put runners on your cars.
Yes. Yeah, they all have snow runners.
Snow runners. No, actually, quick change.
Someday I'll
tires.
I'll put snowmobile tracks on all my cars. That'd be fun.
Oh, I'm glad. Tanks. I live on the other side of the country, so I'm good. No, good. For you listening, I wonder where you find yourself in this spectrum. You know, do you have that enthusiastic culture of let's go learn something, let's go build, test, and fix, and iterate, and feed the invention machines, or is it very, very cautious? So the other end of the spectrum, where it's all under wraps until you formally launch it, and then you're totally exposed. And I'm sure there's variations all the way along that spectrum. But what do you see I'd be interested in what our listeners think is the biggest barriers to getting protos early and testing with customers early and all those kinds of things. It's because I think that's one of our biggest barriers. I wonder how people have solved that. So they can go over. You can go over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And please let us know. We've been getting more and more comments and feedback and suggestions. And so in part, this episode was, well, how do you do that? How do you get this feedback? So we really, really appreciate all the feedback we're getting. So I look forward to some more of that. So with that, Adam, you know it's not snowing in Boston anymore. I think
finally.
You're past that. So, all right. Well, we'll talk to you later then, Adam. Let's wrap it up.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.